From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Leaders of 47 nations gathered in Washington this week for the Nuclear Security Summit, along with press corps from around the world. In his opening remarks, President Barack Obama called the summit a historic occasion. He said that nuclear security is one of the most pressing challenges of our time. It's a matter of humankind's very survival. And that's about when he kicked the media out of the room.
And with that, I'm going to ask we take a few moments to allow the press to exit before our first session.
The Washington Post's Dana Milbank served up a scathing summary of the White House's treatment of the press during the summit. He wrote that reporters were shut out of most proceedings and had virtually no chance for questions. Milbank admits this isn't a new problem. The media always want more access, but the Obama administration's behavior was a bit much.
There's no shortage of press whining, but people have been covering these summits since I was a kid, said they've never seen anything quite like it. Now, what was different here is you did have 50 world leaders there, all, you know, from places like China and Russia, where they don't have the same press freedoms. It seemed to me the president had a chance to show what it's like to have a free society and a free press. Instead, we had the people from the Saudi press agency coming into these meetings and being ushered out after 15 seconds and not being allowed to hear what we once called the leader of the free world was saying.
If we're going to talk the talk, we got to walk the walk, eh?
Look, the president is free to stiff the press as much as he wants. He's been doing that a lot lately, everything from going to his kid's soccer game without alerting the protective White House press bull that usually follows the president around just in case the unthinkable happens. He's had his meeting with Netanyahu without allowing the press to record it. He's signed his executive order on abortion without having the press to record that event. He can get away with that, and he can get away with this, obviously. The question is that the image that you want to project to the world? We literally had the case here where Hu Jintao, the president of China, was more chatty with the Chinese media than the president was with us.
I must say, one of the most appalling details was the way the meetings with other foreign leaders, the so-called bilateral meetings, were reported to the press. Typically, the president stands up with his opposite number from, you know, pick a country, and each takes questions from their own domestic press corps. What was released after the bilateral meetings at the nuclear summit?
Well, you know, there's sort of these anodyne statements. They're called readouts. My favorite one was after the meeting with the Pakistani prime minister, and it said, the president told the prime minister that he's very fond of Pakistan.
Stop the presses. I think the press had some expectation that President Obama, who ran substantially on transparency, would be far more forthcoming than George W. Bush, who explicitly said that he wanted to avoid the media filter and could go directly to his various constituencies. Was this summit emblematic of the way the White House press operation is run in general?
I think it is part of a pattern. I think people did have sort of an unreasonable expectation that suddenly Obama was elected and sunlight would flow through the White House and, you know, we'd all be invited to watch deliberations in the Oval Office. That was unrealistic to expect. He has made some strides. Certainly the good government groups, some of them give him high marks for opening up records, that sort of thing. But I think in terms of dealing with the press, it really has been a disappointment. By many measures, he's taken fewer questions even than George W. Bush, who was often overtly hostile to the press. And I think this is not anything that has to do with ideology. It's just a president saying, I have the ability to control the way the message gets out there, and I don't want to open myself up to the rabble of the press asking me questions that I might not want to talk about.
One of the suggestions is that because this was a nuclear summit and because these are security issues that were discussed, that this was not the subject or the time and place for foreign leaders or the president to just be kind of riffing. Do you think it was the underlying subject matter that made this such a closed affair?
No, I think the technical term for that argument is hogwash. You don't discuss classified secretive things with 50 world leaders, many of whom are not necessarily sympathetic with your interests. Now, President Sarkozy of France, who did actually sit down and have a nice chat with his reporter, said nothing of importance was discussed in the meetings itself. What happens is on the sidelines where you have the one-on-ones with the leaders. So I think that clearly makes the point that there was no reason not to have the public get a glimpse of this. since what was going on inside those rooms was just speechifying anyway.
Now, you said the W word, whining. And let's discuss this, because when you wrote your piece, the Washington Post website was flooded with criticism of you for complaining and whining and being petulant. What do you make of that?
Look, it's to be expected. You make no friends sort of defending the free press. I wrote the same stories, you know, different circumstances, but the same stories about the Bush administration. People on the left would generally say, right on, and people on the right would say I was whining. Now we have people on the left saying I'm whining, and the people on the right say, hey, he's your guy, it's your fault.
So in the end, the president actually did, as you mentioned, have a news conference. Do you think it was a useful exercise?
Well, sure. I think he did take 8 questions for about 20 minutes, and they were serious questions, and they raised the kind of points that people might be wondering. Say, look, you say you have an agreement here, but it's not binding. You say the Chinese are cooperating with sanctions on Iran, but they're not really saying that. Why isn't Israel being forced to declare its nuclear weapons? These are not the sort of happy things you get in the communiques or the blessed readouts from meetings.
And what about his answers? The president said one thing, the Chinese suggested another. How did it play out at the conference?
The president did some hemming and hawing on the questions of China, on the questions of Iran and Israel, and that's his right to hem and haw. But the public should get a chance to see that when tough questions are being put to him, how he deals with it.
Dana, thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Dana Milbank is a political reporter at The Washington Post. He also writes the Washington Sketch column about political theater in the Capitol.
Speaking of political theater, this week, Manchester, England was the scene of a premiere. It was the first time British party leaders have ever gone head-to-head-to-head in a live televised debate. Thursday's debate was the first of 3 scheduled before the May 6th election. This was pretty much an American show with a British cast, with former Obama advisors helping to prep both the Conservative candidate David Cameron and the ruling Labour Party's Gordon Brown. Don't know who was directing the third-party Liberal Democrat Nick Clegg. The 3 parties hammered out 76 rules of engagement. Among them, the audience had to be politically balanced. Their questions were carefully vetted and had to relate to all 3 candidates. No cheering or booing allowed. The moderator enforced the rules but was permitted no questions of his own. Snap polls immediately after the event anointed Nick Clegg the winner. Yes, a very American affair. So much so that an American university professor writing for the Financial Times used an American phrase to describe what such debates demand. A blend of spontaneity and kabuki. Kabuki. John Lackman is a PhD student in art history who was really bothered by the way the word kabuki is used and abused. He recently wrote a piece in Slate called It's Time to Retire, Kabuki.
Just imagine the thing that you really love just becomes, you know, an insult in everyone else's vocabulary and it gets under your skin. And I'm all for people reaching for a new word when one seems to be necessary. And American politics does seem to demand some kind of linguistic innovation as it descends into ever greater depths. I just don't think this is the right thing that we're looking for. It's not only not fair to kabuki, but it doesn't really make sense. There's really no instance you can come up with where somebody has used kabuki where the word theater or the word ritual wouldn't have served just as well.
So what is it we're trying to communicate when we invoke kabuki?
It's used basically just to tar something as theater or as ritual, which is to say when people in politics seem to be getting up in front of the public and putting on a show that has little to do with substance and everything to do with making a certain impression.
Can you give me some examples?
It got a lot of usage recently with the healthcare debate, particularly around the healthcare summit. For example, Frank Rich used it. Michelle Malkin ran one of her columns with the headline, Oba Kabuki, a box office bomb.
Is invoking kabuki in this way a universal or is it particularly American?
I got curious about that as I was writing my piece, and I did searches both on the internet and in news databases of French media, German media, Italian media, and it doesn't show up in other languages as far as I can tell, and it doesn't even show up in English-speaking media outside of America. I could find almost no instances in British media, Australian media, etc.
Well, how about Japanese media?
Well, I can't really do Japanese language searches of Japanese media, but there are some Japanese publications that are either published in English or have an English edition. And I couldn't find instances there either of the word being used this way.
You identified the original culprit, didn't you? The person who started the Kabuki cavalcade?
It seems to have cropped up in the early 1960s. This was a time when World War II was a receding memory, but American-Japanese relations were still very tense. And an American official had recently visited the country, the White House press secretary, in order to hopefully pave the way for a presidential visit. When he arrived, his car leaving the airport was quickly surrounded by an angry mob that started banging on the windows and rocking his car. And some reporters believe that if the police hadn't arrived when they had, that he would have been killed. And so this was a time when relations were tense, and along came this Los Angeles Times writer who was writing about domestic politics, and he didn't like what he was seeing going on at the State Department, and he decided to refer to it as shoddy left-wing kabuki, with no explanation by what he meant by the word kabuki, which must have been unfamiliar to most of his readers. And ever since then, it crops up all the time, sometimes more than others, but it seems particularly rife lately, and that was what inspired me to write the piece.
You checked on the media's archives, didn't you?
I did. And there are instances.
John, thank you very much.
Thank you.
John Lackman is a PhD student in art history. His Slate piece is called It's Time to Retire Kabuki.
Should there be some sort of disclosure or disclaimer box that says that you are witnessing kabuki theater? Please understand.
Be they kabuki dancers or law students, in the end, it was the senators who took
his watch. Is this bit of PR kabuki taking
place? But it all seems like so much kabuki or shadow puppetry or something.
Oh, like you've never used it.
Well, there was this one time.
When it comes to Obama, it really seems that he sheds a sort of cold light of rationality in this sort of political kabuki that we all see.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 15 years ago this Monday, Timothy McVeigh exploded a truck bomb outside the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in downtown Oklahoma City. The blast killed 168 people, including 19 children, and was, until September 11, 2001, the deadliest terrorist attack on American soil. McVeigh had ties to the militia movement and was retaliating for the government's raid on the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, exactly 2 years earlier. But before the FBI identified McVeigh and co-conspirator Terry Nichols as the prime suspects in the bombing, many terrorism experts and news reporters speculated that there might be a Middle East connection. The first World Trade Center bombing had occurred only 3 years before, and it was the Bosnian genocide, the ethnic cleansing of Muslims at the hands of militant Serbs and warlords. Views of the American Muslim community were shaped by that context. Reporter Scott Gurian looks back at the rush to judgment by the media and by law enforcement.
In the 36 hours following the bombing, the Council on American-Islamic Relations documented hundreds of cases of what it calls anti-Muslim backlash across the country. There were reports of vandalism and death threats. Talk radio callers went off on racist rants, and a pregnant Iraqi refugee in Oklahoma City suffered a miscarriage after a group of people threw rocks through her windows and shouted anti-Islamic epithets. Imad Inshasi, the president of the Islamic Society of Greater Oklahoma City, said his fear was sparked the moment he heard the blast.
I remember very vividly that I was going to the bank to make a deposit at 9:01, where I could hear a very loud explosion. My secretary at that time, she told me this sounded like some kind of a thunder or something. I said, well, having lived in Lebanon, this sounds like an explosion.
Governor, describe for us, as you walked through the building, what did you see?
Well, it's Beirut. I mean, it's just incredible.
Sure enough, on the radio, the news was some kind of an explosion downtown, still not familiar with what it was. And not too far after that, when it was concluded that it was some kind of a car bomb and so on and so forth, the news traveled very fast, and all of a sudden on the news they were looking for two Middle Eastern Arabs with a description that fits my profiles. And we realized that it was it's going to be troublesome.
Three suspects, three men, two of whom are described as Middle Eastern. They're said to be driving a brown Chevrolet pickup.
To the local newspaper and one of the local television stations by someone saying they represented an Islamic group claiming responsibility. But at this point, no official
One of the descriptions is a 20 to 25-year-old male wearing blue jogging suit, another 35 to 38-year-old wearing a blue jogging suit and brown pants, beard, mustache,
and brown Oklahoma City also said a member of the Nation of Islam claimed responsibility, but that group also vehemently denies any connection with the attack.
Part of the reason so much early suspicion was cast on Middle Easterners was the government's detention of Oklahoma City resident Abraham Ahmed. Ahmed was a Palestinian American en route to visit his family in Amman, Jordan on the morning of April 19th. He fit the FBI's profile, and the contents of his luggage raised some suspicions, so he was taken into custody at London's Heathrow Airport, sent back to Washington, and held for 3 days. He had no connection to the bombing, but was portrayed in the media as a guilty man.
And I was sitting at home watching it, and I believed it.
Imad Inshasi.
That I believe my very best friend that I grew up with and I went to college with could have been one of the perpetrators. And then I go back to my senses and said, no, there's no way he would do that. But then I'll go back and see some of the news reports, some of the expert reports, and some of the media, Channel 4, Channel 5, Channel 9, coming back saying they found bomb-making material in his luggage and so on and so forth. So I believe it. It was a very strong message, even to me, who was Muslim and who knew that person very, very, very well, that I have believed that he could have done something like that. So imagine what kind of an effect it would have on a regular person on the street.
Ibrahim Hooper is spokesperson for the Council on American Islamic Relations.
After those first initial days when it was thought that Middle Easterners or Muslims or whoever had done it, we saw that when it was clear that that was not the case, it was like a slap in the face for many people. And they recognized that, you know, this isn't the way you need to look at things, that you can have domestic terrorism, that people who look like, quote, regular Americans can be terrorists.
The FBI says the majority of terrorist incidents and attacks in the U.S. come from within. But as Jim Narikis with the liberal media watchdog group Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting has observed, that runs counter to the media's prevailing narrative, or as he calls it, metaphor.
The main metaphors are the invasion metaphor and the infection metaphor. And in both cases, you're thinking of something that is coming from outside the body politic and is entering against your will. And if you could only keep that out, then you'd be safe. There is kind of a xenophobia lying beneath it, that terrorism is what you get when you are exposed to the other. And so the solution to terrorism is to have a heightened awareness and a suspicion of the other.
In part, it's suspicion of the other that motivates the militia movement, which is on the rise. That's why it's important to remember not just September 11th, 2001, but also April 19th, 1995. For On the Media, I'm Scott Gurian.
April 19th is a day we will have little chance to forget because our domestic terrorists or would-be terrorists insist on reminding us every few years. We decided to trace April 19th and its equally fraught companion, April 20th, back to where it all began. So many symbols twisted into dark narratives, so much magical thinking about a date, starting with one celebrated act of violence on April 19th, 1775. Later, Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, "By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled, here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world."
Next notable date for some militias, April 20th, 1889, Hitler's birthday. Others cite April 19th, 1943, as the date the Nazis invaded the Warsaw Ghetto. Yet another instance of government forces marching on the innocent. That the innocent were Jews is not emphasized. Then, April 20th, 1985, 300 agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms raided the Arkansas compound of the Covenant of the Sword and the Arm of the Lord, one of the original far-right militias. It served as the model and inspiration for many that followed.
Newsweek quoted a newsletter published by the militia of Montana that pounded the importance of April 19th. It was the shot heard round the world, the date in 1992 the militias claimed of an aborted ATF raid on white supremacist Randy Weaver, whose wife later was shot dead by FBI snipers at Ruby Ridge. Now, we couldn't find any documentation of that April 19th raid. April 19th, 1995 was the scheduled date for the execution of Richard Wayne Snell, a white supremacist who, like Weaver, Newsweek noted, was regarded as a movement martyr. Snell, convicted of killing a pawn shop operator, was executed just hours after the Oklahoma City bombing, after telling his executioners that they had picked a bad day.
But before Oklahoma City, there was Waco. April 19th, 1993, the end of a 51-day siege of the Branch Davidian cult by agents of the ATF, in which more than 70 men, women, and children died in a fire.
Well, as you can see, the parts of the building have collapsed. The fire has indeed engulfed the vast majority of this compound that has been
Bonnie,
the site.
The entire roof is gone.
The entire roof is gone. Mike, what else can you tell us? Any sign of firefighting equipment?
I know. None whatsoever.
It was Waco that inspired Timothy McVeigh, and it was April 19th that he put on his fake driver's license he used to rent the truck used in the bombing. It was Waco and Oklahoma City that inspired Columbine High School students Dylan Klebold and Eric Harris.
They dressed in black trench coats. They hated jocks. Today they brought their guns and their grudges to school, then started shooting.
Anything in the hands of the unbalanced and disturbed can be dangerous. Even a date, April 19th, has been anointed a day of remembrance. And it's worth remembering that there are people out there whose calendars are marked a whole lot differently than yours or mine.
In a recent column, NPR Ombudsman Alicia Shepard asks, where are the women? Shepard monitored NPR's flagship shows, Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Weekend Edition, and Weekend All Things Considered, to determine how often NPR uses women as commentators or sources in its stories. She acknowledged that her study wasn't scientifically perfect, but the results were so lopsided she was sure she was onto something. For example, she found that only 26% of the sources in NPR stories were women, and NPR is by no means alone. Many media outlets have tried and failed to integrate more women and minorities as sources and commentators, nor has On the Media covered itself in glory on that score. So why is that? Reason one, laziness. We have our Rolodex of reliable sources, and why fix a system that ain't broke? Reason two, failure to realize that a system that breeds such complacency is broke. And reason three, fewer females in the pundit pool. One person who's paid a lot of attention to that last issue is NYU professor Clay Shirky. He wrote a blog post earlier this year called A Rant About Women. Clay, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, first of all, let's both acknowledge the irony in our inviting you, a man on the show, to talk about why women are underrepresented in the media.
Duly acknowledged. There was recently a panel at a conference on what can men do to get more women in tech, and the panel was entirely male. And the irony of that was lost evidently on the conference organizers, but not on the audience.
We decided to go with you because earlier this year, you did this very public thing. It got a lot of attention. Why did you write your rant?
I wrote the rant, and I wrote it as a rant, not as a thoughtful, well-considered article, but just as a rant because I felt like I had to blow my stack about what I was seeing happen with my students when they entered the workforce. Within the interactive telecommunications program where I teach, you would not walk into that environment and think, oh my goodness, the men are so much more talented than the women. But when those students get out to the world, I see a sorting out that happens along gender lines. And I think at least part of it is that women are not being aggressive enough about saying, I can do that. My work is good. I'm applying for that grant. I'm asking for this recommendation. I'm raising my hand. I'm taking a risk in public.
And you cite a great example. One of your students, a woman, once wrote to a reporter promoting her own work, and she got an interesting response. Can you tell that story?
Yeah. This is the smartest student I've ever had at the Interactive Telecommunications Program. And she hid her light under a bushel when she was a student there. She went on to do graduate work at Columbia. She hid her light under a bushel there. And then one day she said, you know what? I'm done with that. I'm going to start to tell people how good this work is, because she started seeing mediocre male colleagues getting more recognition for their work than she was getting for her own work. And so a reporter was going around asking about game design and game theory. And Jessica, my student, said, my work is awesome. You should write about me. And the reporter wrote back and said, I've taken a look at it. Your work is indeed awesome. I will indeed write about you. But I also have to tell you, you are the only woman to put yourself forward. Women put each other forward. Men put women forward. Men put themselves forward. Women never put themselves forward. So
you write, not enough women have what it takes to behave like arrogant, self-aggrandizing jerks.
Right. I said it then. I believe it now. I think the concern for how other people think about you is one of the sources of essentially work paralysis among women. One of the big skills that you need, and my institution does not do a good job of inculcating this in women. There are not enough institutions that do. One of the big skills is to be able to do what you want to do without caring what other people think.
You have to acknowledge the fact that when women put themselves out there, they're called biatches. The word shrill is applied to them. They are not called leaders. They are not called strong.
That is right.
They're called strident hags. And it's a pain in the butt.
The single biggest mistake I made in that rant was not to acknowledge that fact. It's true. I knew it was true when I wrote it. I didn't say it, and it was dumb. The reason I think women should get better at behaving like arrogant, self-aggrandizing jerks when the situation calls for it isn't that it will work as well as it works for men, because women are indeed more punished for putting themselves forward than men are. The reason I think that women should do that more is that they will get more of the kind of success they imagine for themselves than if they don't do it, even given the unfairness of the discrimination they face itself.
You write, women aren't just bad at behaving like arrogant, self-aggrandizing jerks. They are bad at behaving like self-promoting narcissists, antisocial obsessives, or pompous blowhards, even a little bit, even temporarily, when it would be in their best interests to do so. Whatever bad things you can say about those behaviors, you can't say they are underrepresented among people who have changed the world. What was the reaction to that?
The number of people have said, oh, thank you for this. I think this is exactly right. A number of people have said, you should never write on this subject in public again because you were so obviously and voluminously wrong. I'll tell you, though, the reaction that has surprised me most is that any number of people, many of them women, have come forward and said, essentially, women have a different way of getting along in the world. We're more social. We're more nurturing and so forth. And I have two problems with that attitude. The first is essentially that if you flowered up the language a little bit, you could dump that into a Victorian almanac. And the second is that all of that kind of nurturing social junk imagines that the best role we can imagine for women in the workplace is as kind of middle management mommies, right? They don't get to found the company. They don't get to run the company. Maybe someday they can be senior vice president of marketing, but mostly they're there in this kind of middle layer of management to keep things running.
So what was your reaction to the findings of the NPR ombudsman? Have you got any guesses based on your experience as a media consultant and in academia as to why this is the case at NPR and so many other news outlets?
I think the list you went through at the beginning, all of the various reasons that you just sort of go for the slots, is exactly right. I think the only thing I might add to the list is that the dialectical model of radio, where you get two strongly opposing voices, favors people who put themselves forward and say, I will express a point of view with absolute clarity, even if it turns out to be wrong, because that makes good radio.
Certainty. It's a wonderful thing,
yep.
Even if it's entirely unjustified.
Right. Male answer syndrome. Yeah, one of the great ways to find out whether or not you're completely wrong is to behave as if you're completely right.
In your view, what is the impact of having so many more male voices as experts and sources than women?
I think one of the big impacts is that the male voice is what expertise comes to sound like. And so even from someone who doesn't go in with a formally sexist bias about whether men are more expert than women in general, you may just unconsciously flip through to those parts of the Rolodex. Someone somewhere has to say, we have to change the fact of the representation before we change people's mental model of what expertise sounds like. Because if we just wait, we will always lag the cultural change rather than leading it.
Clay, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke. Thanks for having me.
Clay Shirky is a professor at New York University and author of Here Comes Everybody, The Power of Organizing Without Organizations.
A new kind of newsroom wins the Pulitzer for investigative journalism, and Dave Eggers' Valentine to the newspapers of yore.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year, and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development at cityyear.org. The John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Those who despair over the fate of newspapers and probing journalism may look to this year's Pulitzer Prizes as one hopeful indication of the future. For the first time, the award for investigative reporting went to an online news outlet, in this case, the not-for-profit website ProPublica.org, for its story about a beleaguered hospital in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. On Monday, August 29th, 2005, as the hurricane made landfall, hundreds of patients and staff were stranded inside of Memorial Medical Center in New Orleans. Over the next 3 days, as the levees broke and the floodwaters rose, conditions inside Memorial deteriorated so severely that some doctors allegedly euthanized patients they deemed too sick or too immobile to be evacuated. The fog of war-like atmosphere evoked by the story is at the core of the reporting's subtlety and strength. ProPublica's Sherry Fink wrote the 13,000-word account, which appeared also in the New York Times Magazine. Sherry, congratulations.
Thank you.
Before we get to some of the journalistic issues, I want to talk about the events themselves. Your story begins at Memorial just as the hurricane hits. Tell me what the patients and the staff were facing.
The power was knocked out. It grew really, really hot inside. It was very hot outside, summer in New Orleans. There was no running water. Rescue was taking a lot longer than people had anticipated. And they started to get worried and in some cases panic. And nobody was really prepared for this kind of situation.
A number of patients in various degrees of extremis, a couple dozen of them, were injected, according to pathology reports, with some mix of morphine and another drug that effectively put them to sleep and eventually killed them. As I read the story, a group of exhausted, frightened, desperate medical personnel found themselves playing God, and they did a very bad job of it.
That is certainly one interpretation of events. Were they trying to give these medicines to treat pain? If so, that's considered okay under medical ethics. If they were trying to hasten death, which some of the doctors actually told me they were, then that's something altogether different. And then it fits much more into the category of what you're talking about. The danger, which is something that arguably happened at this hospital, is that we kind of decide that a group of patients isn't savable. And then when they finally are savable, that doesn't register. That sort of rigid categorization ends up sealing these people's fates.
The story gets particularly chilling as you discuss one patient, a man named Emmett Everett, who was paraplegic and scheduled for some difficult surgery, but also alert and actually quite jolly, you know, a day or two before he was, I guess, lethally injected.
Mr. Everett was a man in his mid-60s. He had something called a spinal cord stroke, which is very rare, but it left him paraplegic, and also he had grown quite obese. The morning before he died, he had fed himself breakfast. He had no medical complaints that morning aside from dizziness, according to the medical staff who were interviewed by investigators after these events. And he could hear that morning when the helicopters finally arrived, one after the other, taking people away. He asked his nurses, he said, "Don't let them leave me behind." Reportedly, a doctor and two nurses who came up to the seventh floor to discuss the situation of the seven patients who were still there assumed that everybody on that floor was really, really sick and was out of it, was unconscious. And the people who actually cared for those patients, they say they told this doctor, "Well, we have one patient who doesn't fit that category at all. He's actually alert, but he's quite obese." And at that point, according to several sources, there was a discussion about, could we get Mr. Everett out? The way that the evacuations were working was that patients would have to be walked down the stairways, because, of course, there were no elevators, down to a second floor, put through a little hole that was a shortcut into the parking garage, then driven up to the top of the garage, carried up two flights of stairs, and then evacuated off the helipad. And they just decided that would just be not possible. Dr. Anna Poe, who was kind of at the center of these events because she was arrested and accused of murder, she, according to the witnesses, and Dr. Poe will not discuss this, of course, but they said that Dr. Poe took these drugs, morphine and midazolam, and went into Mr. Everett's room, closed the door, and several hours later, he was seen by other staff to have died.
You mentioned sources. You know, from reporters' point of view, the bad news is that some of the physicians you spoke to would not speak with you explicitly about the injection of drugs. They talked about the other conditions. The good news is you were able to assemble a remarkable, almost hour-by-hour narrative. What did you have at your disposal to do this with?
The narrative was based on interviews with people who were there, and many, many people. I think I at some point figured out that it was about 140 people. The other thing was documents.
For example, physician's orders that you referred to various times in the piece.
That's one example. So there were prescriptions that Dr. Poe actually wrote to get some of these drugs signed with her name. And then also the scientific evidence. So I had access to the toxicology results and was able to speak with the laboratory head and talk with all of the forensic pathologists and coroner who were involved in the investigation. So it was really triangulating, trying to get several pieces of evidence for each fact that I might be asserting. I went back to every single person who was mentioned in the story and read them what was being said about them and gave them the chance to give their side. All of that helped to put the narrative together.
Now, what I haven't mentioned till now is that you are yourself a physician. Did your personal experience in dealing with critically ill patients inform your reporting on how the doctors dealt with the nightmare that you're writing about?
There are certain principles in medicine, certain ethical principles that everybody who goes through med school, like I have, learns. And I think the big question is whether it's okay to let some of those ethical principles slide in a disaster, because the situation is different from normal in many ways, or whether that's a time where you need to fight harder to uphold those medical principles as best you can. And I've heard people really argue both sides of that.
But, you know, we began this conversation by talking about playing God. I want to ask you, because you are both reporter and doctor, about there but for the grace of God. I want you to, for a moment, put yourself in Memorial Hospital, deprive yourself of sleep for a few days. Can you imagine yourself having been not the reporter of this story, but the subject of it?
I actually, after medical school, ended up volunteering for humanitarian aid organizations for a few years in disaster and conflict situations. And, you know, thank heavens I never faced exactly the situation, but I've certainly been out there doing triage and feeling really overwhelmed. And it's really hard. This story is not about pointing the finger of blame at any of these individuals. It's really, I hope, to give people a taste of what they were faced with when they made these choices. and what led them to make these choices. These are well-respected people who had sterling careers before this point. It's about what can we take from this story into the future so that medical professionals, patients, don't get stuck in this kind of situation again.
Sherry, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Sherry Fink is a reporter for ProPublica.org and recipient this week of the Pulitzer Prize. A grand jury declined to indict Dr. Anna Poe, the focus of Fink's story, and all charges against her were dropped.
This past December, writer Dave Eggers' publishing house McSweeney's released a newspaper called Panorama. But unlike typical newspapers, it was a lustrous and meticulously designed broadsheet edition of 320 pages, featuring long investigative pieces, a 96-page book review, a magazine, full-page color comics, and lengthy takeouts by such luminaries as William T. Volman and Stephen King. Also, unlike newspapers, it was intended to come out only once. This week, I interviewed Eggers at the Conference of the American Society of Newspaper Editors in Washington. He said he began his project to reinvigorate the many journalists still at work in the medium.
And I have so many friends that work at newspapers all over the country and world. We're talking all the time about people losing their jobs and shrinking staff, shrinking news holes, a sense of sense that there needed to be an injection of optimism, I think, about the print form. And I kept saying, no, it can work. And people still love print. And so one of the major factors was to demonstrate what print can do uniquely well and make it distinct from the web.
There's no question that it's a gorgeous demonstration of what can be done with print journalism, given the staff and the money. But with both of those resources in short supply in the typical newsroom, I wondered what lessons Panorama could hold for the audience of daily news editors.
What has this to tell newspaper editors? This is a pay-on to print. It's an homage to the broadsheet. But in a way, it's got very little to do with the business of journalism day to day. How much do you think the Cleveland Plain Dealer would have to pay William Volman for 17,000 words?
I don't agree. I think it's replicatable. Nobody asked William T. Volman to fly down to Imperial County because we assume it's going to cost us $20,000, and that's not necessarily the case. I think so many writers, if given the opportunity and the space and that audience, Bill Volman, you know, his books don't sell hundreds of thousands of copies. If a paper with a 300,000 dedicated circulation every day says, you know what, we're going to give you an 8-page section to talk about something vital. I mean, I know for a fact, because we asked, there's about 200 contributors to this project. Everybody leapt at it, not just because it was friends or anything, but because we said, we're going to give you an expansive amount of space. And I think that that's something so lacking. Everybody gets paralyzed with the fear that they're going to get most of what they write chopped in half for space alone, not for clarity or any other reasons. But if you say, you know, we're going to let this breathe a little bit, you can attract, especially right at this moment, you can attract people that otherwise, in the days when Esquire, GQ, all of these other magazines had much more space for the literary journalism, that doesn't exist as much anymore. So I think the Cleveland Plain Dealer could do the same thing, you know, have this writer on this subject and no one else has it. I don't know, there's a reason to pick it up and pay for it.
It was passed up to me that ASNY really wanted me to ask about leadership. How do you get these people to volunteer, to work for free, to cluster around your effort? And I thought, it's like asking George Clooney how he gets all those girls. I mean, the fact of the matter is, it helps if you write a best-selling novel that's the seed of a new aesthetic that makes irony no longer detached, that unites irony with passionate engagement, and then to naturally draw people who share those passions to you.
It has nothing to do with me, and there was very little volunteer labor, I have to say. Our editors were all paid. On the outskirts, there were interns that were helping out, but everyone was paid.
You said it was 70,000 editorial?
Yeah.
$70,000. And a 350-page paper over 8 to 9 months to produce?
The only people working 8 to 9 months were me and one other guy. Everybody else was more like 5 weeks.
8 to 9 months is a long time for two people.
Yeah.
Something here isn't adding up for me. I mean, maybe I
can do all the math. It's real math. I got to tell you, and like I hear that from all my friends. Well, the math, rah, rah, rah. The math works, and I can apply it to anybody's circulation model. All of you who use freelancers, you might pay $250 for this, you might pay $500 for that. And that's affordable, right? And we were paying more than that for a fraction of the circulation. So freelance shouldn't be as a substitute for staffers, but a whole city like San Francisco or New York or all these cities have so much talent that I don't think we need to create an unhurdleable wall between all of the writers and novelists and freelancers in a given city and our daily staff.
There's been so much said about the new relationship between news consumers and news producers, how this is no longer a one-to-many relationship, but it goes back and forth. What do you think about that?
I want a printed newspaper curated and edited by professionals that have been in the trade for decades, if possible. I am in internal deference to expertise. At the same time, I think that there is opportunities. We had this guy, Wajahat Ali, who was an attorney, who was a playwright and wrote about his adventures in foreclosure law. And we gave him a chance to write it. And we thought, well, if he writes it well, and then we spent about 10 days fact-checking, everything held up, and so we published it. So I think that there's a room there for the less experienced journalists. But mostly, I want to hear from the people that know how to get at the facts, that know where the bodies are buried, that know inside and out of every city hall and government bureaucracy, and tell me what I need to know. That's what I go for the newspaper for. So
let's talk about the traditional role of a newspaper in a community. At least historically, it's come out every day. What you've produced is something that one could take weeks to read all the way through.
Yeah.
And you've said that it was intended to be a kind of idealized Sunday newspaper?
A little bit. I mean, it's a concept card. It's sort of saying, here's all the things that the form can do. And we never said this is a daily newspaper. We said this is a celebration of the print form.
You think that daily is still the best way to go?
For me, I don't know what I would do if I didn't have 2-3 daily papers a day to read. I don't want to read online. I don't want to wake up and look at a screen. I feel like, you know, as a society, if we try to put everything on that same goddamn screen, and pretty soon we're going to be eating on the screen or, like, making love through the screen, it's just sort of like, why does everything have to be on the screen? You know, there's been some study that was quoted on one of our panels that said that even how we read, our blood pressure is different when we read on print than when we read online. I think that it's too exciting and distracting online. There's always some button that wants you to click to cat porn, you know, online. It's just like you're trying to read some article and it's flashing and it's telling you to go somewhere else. And I like the curatorial, the calmness, the authority of a daily paper, but I do think that it's a time to make the paper form more robust and more surprising and beautiful and expansive. People still want to read long form literary journalism, nonfiction, etc. And so why can't the print medium do that and be that home and leave the internet to do the more quick thinking and quick reacting things?
I would really love to ask any of the leaders of the papers in here, what Panorama suggests for you? What can you take away from it? Is it relevant to the work that you do? Go ahead.
I'm Mike Wilson. I'm from the St. Petersburg Times in Florida. To answer your question, Brooke, about whether we thought it was relevant, in my newsroom, absolutely. And the St. Pete Times has a tradition of doing long-form narrative journalism. I took it as a tribute, but also a challenge to do more and do it better. I thought it gave us a chance to look at what news is a little differently. You had a page of news items that had happened, say, in the last month before publication, that was just done in a really delightful way.
Yeah.
And I thought that there was some instruction in that for us in what we put in print, but also, in a sense, what we put on the web. There are interesting things that happen that are small things, but meaningful.
Hi, I'm Diana Marrero with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. I'm curious, you said you read 2 or 3 papers a day. What are they, and what's your favorite newspaper?
Well, I read the Chronicle and the New York Times for sure every day, then the Examiner, which is also in San Francisco that I get free on my block. So those 3 papers every day. And then if I'm anywhere that the USA Today is, I'll read that, and I like the Wall Street Journal a lot. And then I get the Guardian in London sent to me bulk once a month. The Daily Zaman, we now are subscribed to that. That's in English and Turkish every day out of Istanbul. Can you believe it? I'm a fan of the form. You know, I always will be. I'm just in awe of what gets done every day. Having gone through it this time, I was 100 times more in awe of what happens every day. And so I sort of am personally relying upon the survival of the forum, at least until I'm in the grave. Then after that, who knows? Thanks for letting me be here, everybody.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, and PJ Vogt, with more help from Alex Goldman, Lynn Davis, and Peter Henderson, and edited by Brooke. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Michael Rayfield.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.